Today on the 21st Show, Central Illinois writer Judith Valente feels a special connection to Italy. It's her ancestral homeland, and it's also a place of deep spiritual meaning for her. But beyond that, Italy is, she says, a place where people are committed to living la dolce vita, the sweet life. And in her new book, she says even Americans, busy as we are, can taste la dolce vita. The book is The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. I'm Brian Mackey with Judith Valente for the hour, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. Anche se l'esistenza m'avvelena. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is Claudio Villa. Son cose belle le sole. Many Americans live at 2x speed. We check emails during dinner, we rush to the next appointment, and we measure our worth by our productivity. But there are other ways of being. The writer Judith Valente, based in Central Illinois, says we would do well to emulate some of the best traits shared by many people in Italy, who live their lives with what she calls an everyday contemplative mindset. All this and more is the subject of her new book. It's called The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. It offers lessons from a culture that's mastered the art of savoring simple pleasures while maintaining deep connections in family and community. Judith Valente joined us for a conversation that first aired over the summer, so no live calls on the program today, but you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. And now, our conversation with Judith Valente on the dolce vita with an Italian soul. All right, what first drew you to explore Italian culture?
Well, of course, I'm the proud granddaughter of two sets of Italian immigrants who showed a great deal of courage to come to this country with literally nothing in their pockets at the turn of the century. And when I was in high school, our high school offered a trip to Italy. It was my first time there, and I felt a certain at-homeness there, Brian, that I didn't ever feel before anywhere else. But what really triggered my deep appreciation of Italy is being able to spend extended periods, sometimes as long as 3 months at a time, over the past 5 to 7 years in Italy, in small towns and sometimes larger towns, getting to really know the life and the people. And so that's basically was the start of it. And I just began to see that Italians are onto something. They're onto something really beautiful and important that we can incorporate, we can reinvent ourselves with here in the United States.
Say more about that first trip and how you said you felt at home in a way that you had not here in America. Because you're, what, second generation? Yeah. So how is that? Was it an alienation from America? Was it a connection there? Take it where you will.
Yes. Well, there was a certain warmth in Italy that I experienced, a certain sense of community. It's what I always say to people. It's very hard to be anonymous in Italy. It's easy to make friends. And even at that young age, I was just 16. I was a junior in high school that very first time I went. I felt people reaching out to me, people being interested in me. And this is what you will find in Italy, whether you go the first time, you're going for your first time or your 10th time, that people are genuinely interested in you. And it's one place in the world, I might add, where people still love Americans and still appreciate America. So it makes it a lovely place to visit.
While you still can. We're going to get to that a little later in the conversation and some of the dynamics of global travel right now. But I wonder, is this something, even as a young person, did you see this idea of spiritual and contemplative wisdom, or is that something you came to more
over time? Is an interesting story, actually. I became, about 10 years ago, very interested in contemplative spirituality. And what do I mean by contemplative? It's an attitude that sees the sacred and the poetic in the very ordinary substance of everyday life. And I began visiting monasteries and learning about monastic spirituality, which is contemplative spirituality. It's where contemplative spirituality originates from. And I was the youngest grandchild in my family, so I didn't know very well three of my grandparents. One died before I was born, and two others died when I was very young. But one lived to the ripe old age of 95. He was from Sicily, and I was very, very close to him. And I heard his stories of coming to America, his stories of living in Sicily. But what was really interesting, Brian, was I learned that one of those grandmothers that I didn't know very well was from Cassino, Italy, which is, of course, where Monte Cassino is, the monastery founded by Saint Benedict, who is considered the founder of Western monasticism. So I finally got to go to Cassino and found a distant cousin called Mario Valente. But what was really interesting was that my grandmother would have seen Monte Cassino, would have seen this Benedictine monastery every day of her life, because the monastery is way up on a mountaintop, and it kind of overlooks the whole city, presides over the whole city of Cassino. And I realized that this yearning in me for a more contemplative and reflective life probably came from my genes, probably came from my grandmother from Cassino, whom I really didn't know well. And so that was a big revelation for me about my own roots and my understanding of myself and why I was so interested in learning to live a more contemplative life.
The plains of central Illinois can inspire contemplation, but I would imagine it's quite different from overlooking a monastery in the Italian mountains.
Well, I love both.
So let's talk about this idea of Italians as everyday contemplatives. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's almost as if it's something passed down in the genes to them. For example, let me give you a simple example. The reverence for the meal table. Of course, we look at the Mass, the Catholic Mass, and of course Italy is a Catholic country, as a meal, as a Eucharist. And so the meal table in Italy is still a very sacrosanct place. It isn't a place for people to sit down and, you know, eat in 5 minutes and then run off to the more important things they have to do. No, it's a time to sit down and to be in communion with others. And so, you know, a simple practice like that reminds us of the sanctity of what we do when we sit down at a meal table to break bread, you know, that lovely expression, to break bread, an expression for eating with someone else. So it's a very sacred experience in Italy, and anybody who's been there and has eaten in a restaurant or been lucky enough to be invited to an Italian home for a meal, knows what I'm talking about, that it is a time of communion.
Maybe you can talk about that episode where you pull out your laptop during, I think it was a Sunday lunch, if I remember
right,
correctly.
Right,
yeah.
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 Well, you mentioned, you know, how can we emulate the more contemplative lifestyle of the Italians? Well, let me preface the story by saying Italians work to live. They don't live to work. And this impressed me because I've been a chronic workaholic all of my career. I've been a chronic overachiever all of my life. And so this notion that I could take pauses and still be productive was rather new to me, and maybe new to many of your listeners as well. And what really drove it home to me was I was invited by my Italian teacher to her home for a Sunday dinner, which is very sacred still in Italy, the family meal on Sundays. You know, the mother, the father, grandma, grandpa, nonna or nona as they're known, even sometimes ex-son-in-laws, ex-husbands will be invited to the Sunday meal. So I usually write a column on Medium.com on Sundays and also put it out on Facebook and Instagram. And I hadn't quite finished it for that particular Sunday. So I brought my computer to the Sunday meal thinking, oh, I could get a little writing in before the meal begins. So I pull out my computer at the coffee table and begin typing. And I noticed that my friend's mother was looking at me kind of askance. And I said, well, I'm just trying to finish up some work before our meal. And she looked at me and she said, it's Sunday. And so I shut down the computer, kept it out of sight for the rest of the meal. But the real lesson came also later in the day when we had this, you know, lovely 2-hour long meal. And then we took a leisurely walk along the Adriatic to kind of walk off our meal. And it touched me that my Italian teacher, who was then in her late 30s, still strolled arm in arm with her parents, which I thought was so beautiful. And the lesson to me was that I could have this lovely leisurely meal with my friends, go for a beautiful stroll along the water, and still get my work done. Because I finally got the column written just later in the day, but still in time to put it out on Medium.com and Facebook. And that was a real lesson to me to always put friends and friendship ahead of my own work and my own desire to be productive.
I wonder if it's particular to being, you know, a writer and a journalist, the reward for meeting a deadline is you get another deadline, or is this something broader you see in the American culture?
I think it's very broad in the American culture. I think we're a nation of workaholics. Something that I write about in the book is how few Americans take their full allotment of vacation time. In Italy, you get 5 weeks of vacation. You get a week off between Christmas and New Year's so that people can go and be with family and friends. It's, you know, and no one's going to apologize for taking this time off. And here's the thing, Brian. We associate Italy with la dolce vita, as you said, the sweet life, as you said in your introduction. But it's actually the third largest economy in Europe. People in Italy work hard. They work hard, but they don't live to work, which is something we haven't learned to do yet. And somehow their economy keeps going along, even when half the country or three quarters of the country is on vacation at the same time.
All right. You mentioned La Dolce Vita. Maybe we can introduce some of these other Italian concepts you write about in the book. And feel free to correct my pronunciation as we go. But dolce far niente, the sweet do nothing.
Yeah.
What is that?
That's beautiful pronunciation there, Brian. The dolce far niente is the beautiful do nothing. In other words, don't chide yourself. It's okay to simply do nothing. Not always, you know, not 24 hours a day, but there are times when we just have to decompress or detox, as the Italians like to say, to detox. And you can be still productive, as I say, citing the Italian economy, and still take these pauses, take this time for relaxation. And this is a very contemplative and monastic notion. When Saint Benedict wrote his rule for people living in monasteries, he was a genius of organization. He divided the day into equally between work, prayer, study, and rest. And the Benedictines have an expression about holy leisure, that leisure is also a part of our lives. And you might hear it in the sense of people saying keeping the Sabbath. You know, does that mean the Sabbath has to be Sunday? Maybe, maybe not. But it should be, you should have one day of the week where you sort of set aside everything else to nourish the soul. And this is a very important concept in Italy as well.
I wonder if you are comfortable talking about your own, I should say we need to take a break in 3 minutes, but your own sort of faith background. And it sounds like you maybe are seeking something you might not have been getting through those practices.
Right. I think that I was always drawn to something more contemplative and reflective and intentional in a way of living, because my first love in writing before I became a journalist as you mentioned, my first love was writing poetry, and I still write poetry. My third book just came out, and it's full of poems about Italy. It's called How to Be a Contemplative. So you see, I never stray very far from my subject, my theme song, so to speak. But I think that sometimes our emphasis on ritual in religion and faith, and, you know, I covered faith for a long time for PBS TV. That was my beat, faith and values. We associate faith with rituals and doing things. And I think people have become increasingly interested in the more contemplative aspects of living out their faith, of simply observing silence as periods of prayer, of setting out times in the day when they can simply be. And I see this more and more, in people in middle age, my age, who are trying to return to that, which is a very old notion in faith and in Christianity, but we seem to have lost it in recent decades, recent centuries, maybe even.
All right, we need to take a short break. We're listening back to our conversation with Judith Valente. She's the author of a recent book, The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. You might also recognize her from previous work with PBS or from her work in the Wall Street Journal or NPR stations here in Illinois. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Support for the 21st Show comes from the Des Moines Arts Center, presenting Manuel Alvarez Bravo, a pioneer of Mexican photography, featuring collaborators like Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and more. On view through January 18th. More information at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Throughout the hour today, we're listening back to our conversation with Judith Valente, author of The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. We're exploring how Italian culture offers lessons in contemplative living. No live calls for the hour, but you can still reach us by voicemail. The number, 24/7, is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Before the break, we were talking about some of the Italian concepts that you write about in your book. Another one I was intrigued by is fara bella figura. I guess that's presenting your best self.
Right, bella figura. Very good pronunciation there, Brian. Yeah, that's a really interesting concept because it has to do with the image that we present to the world. Italy is very much an outside culture. You know, people live in narrow houses. They live in small apartments. So they're out and about a lot. They want to be seen and be seen. They want to see and be seen, I should say. And so the image that you present to yourself, you present to the rest of the world is very important. I grew up in northern New Jersey in a neighborhood where the mothers would sometimes run to the grocery store with pink curlers in their hair and a green kerchief wrapped around their head. Yeah, this would never do in Italy, for example. My landlord when I lived in Siena was a widow in her 50s. And she, just to go to the bakery or the local department store, she would put on lipstick. She would wear heels and put on a blouse and a skirt. And a friend of mine who married an Italian man told me a very funny story about when they were first married and they went to Italy for the first time. And she was about to run out to the butcher in this kind of old, tattered jumpsuit that she'd probably slept in. And the husband, the Italian husband, turned to her and said, "You're not going out in that, are you?" And she said, "Well, I'm just going to the butcher. Nobody's going to see me. I'm not going to run into anybody I know." And the husband said, "The butcher will see you." And so that's how ingrained it is in the Italian culture. And, you know, what is it really about? Is it about presenting a facade to the rest of the world? No, I don't think so. An Italian friend explained it to me as it's really about love. It's about loving others enough to want to look and be your best, and loving yourself enough to want to feel good in your skin. And I think that's a pretty good way to be.
You're reminding me of another American writer, Gay Talese, who, if I remember correctly, puts on a fancy silk necktie and a suit and goes outside his front door and walks down to a garden apartment beneath his residence right. Where he does his writing.
Right.
But every day he's dressed like that.
Yeah, and there's also we talk about Italy as being a fashion capital of the world, and it's true. I mean, you just look at people and they look beautiful all the time, whether they're enjoying a stroll in the street or they're going to church or they're going to work. They look beautiful. And one of the reasons is, another expression that there is poco ma buono, less but good, or poco, little but good. And it's a way of shopping, really, where you may buy less clothing, less purses, less shoes, even less food, but higher quality, and you pay a little more. And so you're not getting junk and filling your closets up with a lot of shoes that wear out quickly or a lot of clothes that fade quickly. You're really going after quality rather than quantity, which, you know, is very un-American because we love a bargain here in America. It's why dollar stores were, they didn't suffer as much during the COVID lockdown as other stores. We love a bargain here in America. But Italians are going to look for quality over quantity. And I think this, too, is a very contemplative and religious concept because it gets to the idea of waste. If we're buying all this stuff that we don't need or that we're going to have to throw away in a year or less, that's adding to the junk and the pile of garbage in the world. And so I think it's also contemplative to be aware of your buying practices and what you're doing.
Even the way we refer to these things in America, the fast fashion labels and stores, or fast food, or even fast casual, the slightly nicer version of fast food. That's the opposite of the ethos you find in Italy.
Right. Slowness is a dirty word in our culture, but slow is actually something that's very important in Italy. There's a slow food movement, which refers to a couple of things. It refers to what I mentioned before about really sitting down and savoring a meal, savoring the time with your meal mates, whether they're family or friends or colleagues. But also, there's a big movement in Italy of farm to table, where you eat food that you bought that day. You eat food that was grown locally. And these are very important concepts to Italy that Italy is now exporting to the rest of the world. I think we are becoming, as Americans, much more aware of farm to table, where you go into the Kroger or you go into the Hy-Vee and there's these signs that say locally grown, you know. And so we're picking up on that, but it's been a value in Italy for a long time now.
And it's an expensive value here. Yeah. Let me take a moment to remind listeners this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Judith Valente. Her book is The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. I want to turn a page now to one of your, you have some chapters that don't really shy away from the darker periods in Italian history. Why was it important to you to write about fascism under Mussolini?
Right. I felt that to be balanced and to be truthful, you had to look at these less than admirable aspects of life in Italy. And certainly the 20 years of fascism was something that I struggled with a lot because it's so counter to the Italian character. Italians are among the most hospitable people in the world, among the most generous people in the world. How in the world did they end up with 20 years of fascism under Mussolini? And I talked to a lot of people. I looked at a lot of films, read a lot of books. And there's a lot of parallels between what's happening in America now and what was going on in Italy in that period of the 20s to the 40s, where Italy was very depressed, very poverty-stricken after World War I, and looking to a strong man, a strong leader, a pater familias, if you will, a father figure, to lift them out of all that they felt they were suffering. And for a while, it looked good. Mussolini was building a lot of buildings that resembled classical Roman-style buildings. He was giving subsidies to people to have bigger families, especially if they had boys. He loved it when they had boys because they could then join the army eventually. And he was creating a big jobs program for people. But then he was also in the middle of the night coming for people's neighbors and taking them if they happened to be critics of the government, if they happened to be homosexual, if they happened to be of a different religion or a different race. And this did not sit well with the Italians. And then, of course, he got them into World War II. And Italians are not a belligerent people. They didn't like this. And so they eventually turned against Mussolini. But it took 20 years. And I think it's a real, alarm ringer for our country that if we keep going down the path of allowing our leaders to have unlimited, unchecked power, it's going to take a long time to untangle from that.
Yeah, so I mean, there are parallels, as you mentioned. There are obviously distinguishing features as well. I don't want to overstate it, but I mean, what other lessons do you think there are other than stop it from happening? And it could take a while to recover.
Well, just there's an expression that, and I think it was a Jesuit who said this, that, you know, yesterday they came for my coworker. The day before they came for my neighbor. Today they're coming for me. You know, how long will it take if we are against so many people in this country, if we are demonizing so many groups of people in this country, you know, how long is it going to be before it comes to us? And, you know, I think that we have to keep that in mind, that we have to respect everyone's rights, and we're seeing sort of a diminution of that here right now in some aspects.
You also write about the mafia influence on Italian society. How do people think about that now?
Right. There's been a marked change. The mafia was so ingrained in societies, particularly in small towns, because the mafia had a lot of largesse to give out. For example, if somebody wanted to start a business or something, the mafia would extend their money to them. But this was not without a price, because of course you had to give your kickbacks to the mafia, and people went along with this for a while because there were some benefits to it. But then it got very out of hand around the 70s and the 80s, where the mafia was putting bombs in public places and assassinating prosecutors who tried to bring some of the members of the mafia to justice. For example, when I worked for the Wall Street Journal, I was sent to Milan. I was stationed in London at the time and sent to Milan. And right across from our office in Milan, a bomb went off in a park, killing one man who happened to be in the park. And luckily, I and my colleagues were working late that night, and we had gone out to dinner. We had gone out to a late dinner, because I don't know what would have happened if, you know, we had walked past that park when the bomb went off. And so at some point, particularly when two very famous prosecutors from Sicily, Giovanni Falcone and Paolo Borsellino, were killed. They were very popular figures. They were killed within weeks of each other by car bombs. The Italians said enough, and they really turned against the mafia. And there was a big sea change in the country, to where now it's very regular to see in the Italian newspapers different mafia figures being brought to justice after 20 years, you know, after them being on the run for 20 years, they're being brought to justice. And I think that the mafia has lost a lot of its sheen, shall I say, in Italy.
Though perhaps not in American movie theaters. You know, one other parallel that struck me is Italy was well ahead of America in electing media figures, entertainment figures to high office. I wonder if there are lessons from Berlusconi's rise.
Well, I think people, I think if you go to Italy today, there's not a lot of respect for Berlusconi. He was a very shady character in many ways, you know, with all his women and his partying. And yes, he was a very successful businessman, but he wasn't a very good human being. And right now, Italy has kind of a middle of the road, I would say, center of right government, and it's being led by Giorgia Meloni, who is a woman. And I think it's wonderful that Italy has elected a woman where we have never elected a woman in the U.S. But I was fearful when she first was elected that she would be far too conservative, far too rightist, but she's really she's governed not in the center, but perhaps the left of the right.
And left of where the worst fears might have been.
Left of where the worst fears might have been. Yeah. And, you know, and I think she's proving herself to be a stateswoman on the world stage, as you can see from the fact that President Trump even has said nice things about her.
So, you know, we like to talk about America as the world's oldest democracy. Italians, if you think back to Roman times, have some experience of that, although it was by far, you know, not a perfect democracy when it was, and it was also an authoritarian regime. I wonder, you know, bottom line, you know, we've talked about fascism, organized crime, this idea of media figures dominating politics. I wonder if you think that Italians offer us any lessons about protecting our democratic culture and institutions, more broadly speaking.
I'll put it in this context, that there's a tremendous sense of community in Italy. And you see it in the fact that people are always talking to one another. They're talking in the streets, under the arches. They're talking in the cafes. They're talking in their homes. And this gives a sense of belonging. We, I think, have lost kind of a sense of belonging, kind of. We have lost a sense of community here and a sense of belonging in the U.S. And I think that their democracy will be preserved in Italy, perhaps more easily than ours might be, sad to say, because of this sense of community. And I remember during the COVID crisis, where people were showing up at state capitals here with guns, demanding the reopening of schools, demanding the reopening of businesses, criticizing the mask mandate. Well, they had the same thing in Italy, and Italy was very hard hit by COVID. But what you saw in Italy was kind of a coming together of people. That when they were locked into their homes and they couldn't go places except perhaps to the pharmacy or to the supermarket, what did they do? They got out on their balconies and they played musical instruments. They sang arias and folk songs. They built up this sense of community. And an image that really struck me from that time was a group of Capuchin priests. They sort of defied the stay-at-home order, and they walked through the streets with a monstrance with a Catholic Eucharist in it, and blessing the homes. And so there was this coming together, not this tearing apart and splitting apart that we experienced.
Yeah. All right, we need to take another break on the program. We're listening to our conversation with Judith Valente, which occurred earlier this year during the summer. Her book is The Italian Soul: how to savor the full joys of life. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
Vieni, è la strada del cuore, dove nasce l'amore.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is Respighi's The Pines of Rome from the movement The Pines of Villa Borghese, one of the great works of Italian classical music. This, as we listen back to our conversation with Judith Valente, who's a writer based in central Illinois. Her latest book is called The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. She's also been a journalist. She was religion reporter and correspondent for PBS. She also previously reported at the Wall Street Journal, where she was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for feature writing back in the early 90s. Since our conversation today is on tape, no live calls, but we did take a call when this first aired, so let's go to Tana, calling from rural Menard County.
Hi there. Glad to be on your show. First time I heard about Niemöller's prose piece was back in the late 60s, and it literally slammed me in the brain. He was a Hitler, well, my understanding, I don't know for sure, was he was a Hitler supporter, and then the group he was a member of started getting arrested and put in prison. And so this happened to him too. And it just speaks to so strongly to what's going on right now, because that thing, first they came for the trade unionists, and then they came for the communists, and then they came for this group and that group and this group, and then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up for me. It makes me want to cry. We have got to be brave. We have got to be brave. And I really, who knows, I think I have some... ancestry that was Italian in my background, and I understand that they were Jew and they had been Jewish and converted to Catholicism. Blah blah blah. It's a long story.
Sure,
we are all a melting pot, and the fact that we just are so intolerant. My goodness. Anyway.
Well, Tana, thank you so much for sharing your perspective on that. I really appreciate it, Judith. I don't know if you want to respond to that. We were talking about the Niemöller prose poem before the break.
Right. Yeah. No. The caller makes a good point. And yes, we have to resist it when we see other people being dehumanized or being made out to be something that they're not, whole groups of people being made out to be criminals. I particularly have a soft spot in my heart for immigrants because I'm the granddaughter of immigrants. And I believe that it takes so much courage to come to this country that you might want people like that in your country. You know, you asked before, Brian, if I was lacking something or feeling I was lacking something in America when I mentioned that sense of at-homeness in Italy. And it wasn't so much that I felt something was lacking in my life, but that I felt I had found something, kind of an extension of who I was when I went to Italy. I love being American. I owe so much to life in America. My father drove a truck. My mother went to work in a food factory to put me through Catholic high school. I got a literary scholarship from a Jesuit university to go to college. I owe a lot to this country. I owe my whole career to the opportunities that I was given. So I love this country. But Italy allowed me to bridge different parts of myself, so to speak. So just wanted to clarify that.
Sure, sure. All right, another call. Steve is calling from Springfield. Steve, thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, so far when you've been talking about Italy, but without any reference to the different regions of Italy, and I mean, it's a very long country, and it's more or less divided between this southern regions, the central regions, and the north. And my understanding is that they have different ways of life in these different regions of Italy, especially the difference between the north and the south, who don't even have a very high regard for each other, as I understand it. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that, because I don't think it's as contemplative in Milan as the way of life that is, as it is in the extreme south, for to take. So I wondered if you could maybe speak about that a little bit.
Thank you so much for the call, Steve. I appreciate it. Judith?
Yeah, it's a good point, Steve. Thank you. Yeah, there are some differences, but it's all still Italy. I happen to love the South, and I find the real Italy, what I call the real Italy, in not only in the South, but especially in the small towns. So people often say, well, where do you recommend I go in Italy? And I say, well, you know, of course, everyone wants to see Rome and Florence and Venice at least once, and maybe some of the other sites like the Amalfi Coast. Although I ran as fast as I could from the Amalfi Coast. It's very crowded. It's very overexpensive. But these small towns is where you really get a sense of how day-to-day Italians live. And I love the South. I love Abruzzo, which is a region on the Adriatic coast on the southeast, sort of south-central Italy. That's where I go most of the time now, because it's a place that doesn't have a lot of tourism yet, like Tuscany would have, and the area around Venice, for example, or Liguria, for example. Where you have different resort towns, or the Amalfi Coast. So that's what I like to do. And I see, I really feel like I'm in the real Italy there, and I'm able to connect to the rhythm of life in the small towns more easily and make friendships, which are among the best reasons for travel, are the friends that you make.
So if somebody is listening to this and maybe they are interested in going to Italy, what advice do you have? How do you even begin to take on something like that? And maybe we can then address, especially at a time like this.
Well, right? Open up the map of Italy and see where you haven't been before, and look at some of these other beautiful regions like Basilicata, that's in the south. Molise. Molise is next to Abruzzo, which I mentioned. Puglia. Puglia is that heel, that thin heel of Italy, where there's these absolutely lovely beaches. And you can go there for a very affordable price, find very affordable hotels and restaurants, etc. Whereas, for example, if you go to the Amalfi Coast, it's going to be quite expensive. If you go to Venice, it's going to be quite expensive. I would say get all that out of your system, those main cities in Italy, because you want to see the ancient ruins of Rome. You want to see the art in Florence. You want to see the canals in Venice. But then explore outside of that area. Molise is an interesting province. They actually came up with a motto for tourism, Molise non existe. Molise doesn't exist, to show that if you go there, you're not going to be find the hordes of tourists that you would, say, at the Trevi Fountain.
Yeah, birds aren't real. Molise doesn't exist. All right, so you are also an advocate for slow tourism. Talk about what that means, and maybe, you know, is there a difference? I think it was Paul Fussell who said there's a difference between being a traveler and a tourist.
Absolutely, there's a difference. I recommend picking a place, if possible, picking a place like Sicily, somewhere in Sicily, or Abruzzo or Molise, a small town, pick a small town and stay there. Stay in that small town for your 1 week or your 2 weeks, and then take day trips, for example. But that way you get to experience the rhythm of life in a small town. You get to meet people because there's all these small businesses. You get your fruit from the fruit stand, you get your cheese from the cheese store, and you get to know these merchants. You begin to have a relationship with them even after a week or so. And so that's what I recommend. I take a group, for the past 3 years, I've taken a group to Italy for what's called the Benedictine Footprints Retreat. And we go to lesser-known sacred sites, often Benedictine monastic sites. But we spend our time, we spend our time in one town, the little town of Guardia Grele in Abruzzo, and we take day trips from there. And people who come love it because they get to know the mayor and the vice mayor and the woman who runs the bakery store and the little town center of the town grocery store. And we've had, I have a woman who's in her 80s who's come now for the third, coming for the third time on that trip. So I guess she appreciates it. And then we have somebody coming this year for the second time on the trip because it's a very different tourism experience.
What about bringing some of these everyday contemplative practices to our lives here? What advice do you have? Because I got to tell you, I got to meet with the team after the show, and then I got to think about tomorrow's show, and you know, the boss wants to meet, and my kids have to do this and that, and it could be very challenging to try and especially when you're in a culture that hasn't all read your book. We'll put it that way.
Well, as we started the show talking about the meal table, think about your meal this evening. Are you going to sit down with your wife and your children? Is it going to be a time of communion for your family? Or is it going to be, one is off to soccer, one is off to swimming, this and that, everybody eating different things because they don't all like the same thing. No, is it a time for real communion at the table? And then I would say, is there a possibility, Brian, for you to just take even 5 minutes to just do nothing, to just sit and stare out the window at some flower boxes or at a tree? I mean, even if you just took 5 minutes, if you just got outside for a while during the day, walking is a huge thing in Italy. And we haven't talked about this yet, but the life expectancy in Italy is one of the highest in the world. It's the second highest in Europe, only behind Switzerland. And Italians live on an average 5 years longer than Americans do. We, in terms of our life expectancy, we're 38th in the world, 38th behind Albania, Panama, and the Czech Republic. And I think it's because Italians are walking around. They're eating things that are locally grown, things that are grown without a lot of pesticides. And there is this sense of community and belonging that I think adds to a person's life expectancy in a big way. You know, Mother Teresa, when she came to the United States the first time, said that the great American illness is not cancer or heart disease. It is loneliness. And I think that does add to why we don't live as long as many developed people in many developed countries.
Judith Valente is the author of The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life, among other books. We'll have a link to that on our website. Judith, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your book with us today here on the 21st Show.
Oh, grazie mille to you, Brian. Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have on our program today. Coming up tomorrow, for stations that are sticking with us for Thanksgiving, we'll hear from an Illinois chef about Midwestern cuisine, what it is, where it came from, and how it's influenced the American menu beyond our region. Plus, we'll hear about some of your favorite dishes, perhaps as you're making some of your favorite dishes. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.
Tutte quante. to